divide the day into two things. I first want to complete the power of the ruler of the empire, of this head of the priestly caste of Egypt, whom we call the great house Pharaoh, and his creation. And then we shall try to make a comparison, strike a comparison between the tribal achievement and the imperial. Introductorily, I perhaps should come back to this strange question of our friend Prinzner, where the white people ceased to be Bedouins and became settlers. Was it advantageous? I got very mad at him, because I still think this is a terrible question which shows that you are all only naturalists and do not feel reverence for history. I mean, you can't ask why did my father marry my mother. That's because you have to put up with it. You are the heir. So it wasn't advantageous for them to marry, but thank God that you are here. But I want to give a more explicit answer, gentlemen. If, as I think it is true, and so simple that you will not deny it, man is that animal which can only survive on this earth if he is one through all times and all spaces. If we have all to become able to march as one man from the beginning of time to the end over this earth, this is a very clear proposition, I think, then every one step that leads to this taking possession of the whole earth, you see, and really possession, is inescapable the discovery of our true destiny. Those who do not discover this stay behind. You have always the power to reject this offer of God. You can, of course, become a criminal, you can become an anarchist, you can become a member of the leisure class, or you can become many. You can go soft, you can be a juvenile delinquent, you can take to the, can become a hillbilly. I mean, many people miss the best of history. Most, you may even say, they are just dragged along by the institutions. But you cannot ask why the great deeds of mankind by which we know that we are men consist in discovering the way, the conditions under which we can act together as one man. So my further answer then is that the tribe could never outgrow the number of perhaps 5,000 members. Whereas in Egypt, from the very first day we know it, more than 100,000 people live together in unity, perhaps even 200,000, 300,000, 400,000. Today there live 22 million people. Already in Roman days there were 3 or 4 million people, which is exceedingly large. And for this reason then, gentlemen, there had to be found a completely new approach for a new order of magnitude. After the tribe had exhausted its degree of intensity and building up continuity of 7 generations in time and 5,000 people at once, this is your measurement of a tribe, 7 generations in consciousness, you see, you know of your great-grandfather and you work for your great-grandchild, but beyond that you forget. And since the tribe has never been larger than 5,000, the 5 United Nations here in this country in the Mohawk Trail, their desperate attempt to get bigger, they felt the necessity. They couldn't. They could only unite as nations. They together were perhaps 16 to 18,000 people, but that was all. Because on the tribal oral tattoo basis of immediate dancing, immediate warring, you see, immediate totem pose, you can't go beyond the visible, and the audible. You have to have an assembly at which the totem pole can really be seen by all the warriors of the tribe. They have to be in one spot. The tribe has its natural limitations that you have to be at one time all mobilized and stand on parade ground. Our modern parade ground is the last remnant of the tribal order. The whole army can be seen. That's the idea of a parade, you see. The Campus Martius in Rome, Champ de Mars in Paris, these are still remnants of this idea that soldiers field. Where is it? Yeah. That's still the idea, you see, that the whole male population can be assembled and receive marching orders and law, and can celebrate May 1st or Labor Day, the processions of labor, I mean, in the demonstrations, you see, of striking workers. All this has still to do with the feeling that the political group can assemble. Now, never have the Egyptians been able to assemble. In no empire has ever there been the illusion that all the people could be seen in one spot. It was never there. The heaven, you see, was the projection, the mirror, the focus by which this was made superfluous. So such a step in a new dimension, you cannot discuss. You cannot discuss why Copernicus discovered that the earth turns around the sun, because it was true. You cannot ask why is the truth discovered. Man is out for the truth, except the students of darkness. We are bound to follow the truth. It's an order that's given us. Isn't that true? Now, if man has to become one, and this is his whole life on this earth, to be more one and more one all the time, then he cannot evade the issue. If there is this one chance in a million that one genius in the human race said, let's build heaven. That's not wrong. Pay the penalty, pay the price. And now I come, therefore, to the rule of Horus once more, because the rule of Horus makes out of minus plus, makes out of that part of the bush into which people could not plunge because of the dangers of the flood and the drought, you see, makes paradise. And you can also see that instead of the extensive living of the tribal hunters and shepherds food gatherers, Egypt is the first example of an intensive civilization, of taking seriously one part of the earth and showing what you can do with it. This had never been done before. Roaming tribes can do something with the soil that only one can do done with the earth. But they must always keep sin free and be ready to leave. Now, if you are constantly mobilized, you understand that you will only have huts, and you will only have tents, and you will never build a house, never attempt to pay. All this will have to be discovered, and the way in which it was discovered, my dear friends, now, is it now a little more understandable what I'm trying to say? Was inescapable once it was discovered. Just as after you discover the telephone, everybody wants to use it. But you can never predict that the telephone will be invented. No, nothing to it. Somebody else does invent it. You couldn't predict it had already happened. And yet, when it was there, it is. You cannot ask, is it advantageous? It is very exciting, the history of mankind, but it is not exciting because of men's arbitrariness in it, because of the inescapable necessity which is revealed to us. You cannot turn the clock back. Great people are those who discover the next necessary step in the history of the universe. You have no peace of mind if you remain away from the next step. Just as you become all so neurotic if you try to remain 12 years old. This is what it is. What is rules? Delayed eternity. Now, Horus, the priest emperor of Egypt, we have not quite a word that expresses the unity of Pope and Caesar. The terror of Egypt is not an emperor in our good sense of the word. And it is not a pope in your sense of the word, because he is both. And the pope today wears in the Vatican the three-fold crown of the pair, the Allah, the interpretation of the oldest crown in the world, of the crown of the Pharaoh of Egypt. And the crown makes him into an astral power, because the crown are the rays of the sun. Quite important for you to understand that the crown coronation is an act of of astralization, of making a man a part of the firmament. What is not known, which I'm quite boastful because I have discovered this great labor of 34 years, which I'm going to cover, is the fact that Horus is a star which is lacking in the firmament of heaven as much as on earth. Horus is the one addition of the empire to the stars in heaven. That will sound ridiculous to you, and this is the point I wish to prove first. All our descriptions of antiquities go astray because they do not understand why people on earth should have needed a crowned agent representing heaven on earth. Abuse of it, tyrant, despotism, terrible consequences. You get weaklings on the throne, you get Neros and Sardanapals and so on. If you don't understand it, you will never understand why the Incas ruled or why the Mexicans adored their Montezuma. Now, I think that's a very fair impression. These people were just as intelligent as you and I. They were not at all backward. But the system of the empire, at the time it was constituted, was the next step to taking possession of the universe. And for this purpose, men became God. Now, in the family of gods in the sky, the sun and the moon and the stars were the natural adepts or the natural members of the divine family. There was one member who was a human, that was the emperor. All the kings in Homer still are called sons of Zeus, because these sons of Zeus had one wonderful capacity which Zeus was lacking. What is the capacity in the sky that which no star had? How does the stars move? Can you describe to me the heavens moving? In which direction do they go? How does the sun move? And touching in the process, which other part of the globe? So does it go straight from east to west, doesn't it? Over the... Where is it at noon? Yeah, well, a little bit to this. Come. At midnight, the first people didn't know where the sun was. They had all kind of strange ideas. They had, for example, the idea that there was a big mountain in the north behind which the sun was passing, but one couldn't see it. That has given rise in all antiquity to the story of the Hyperboreans, the people who lived beyond that mountain. So when the sun at midnight was dark, couldn't be seen, it was because of the high Alps, because of the high mountains in the north, and they blocked it off. There were many speculations, because what the sun did at midnight, one didn't know. From this it would appear, how does the moon go? Then we have stars in the northern sky who never leave the northern sky. They were called in Egypt the stars that do not set, imperishable stars. That's the northern star, the Arcturus, the Charles Wayne, and the little great name. From this they gathered that the sky did not offer a perfect harmony, because instead of having a perfect rotation and a perfect circle, there was a gap between north, south and west on the one hand side and the north on the other. Now if you look at the, remember, that is very easy for you, I hope you have in mind the map of Egypt. So one straight stroke going from south to north. You can see that the Nile, very differently from the heavens, does flow and move from south to north. So the only important feature of the whole country of Egypt on the bottom line does exactly that which the stars in heaven won't do. I also told you that on Earth there were 36 districts in space laid out as temple districts, from which at the same day, on the same day, all the seed and all the harvesting and all the plowing
would be ordered and performed by the priests.
On the other hand, I told you that in the sky, the movements of always one constellation above the horizon gave rise to the division of the sky into 36 times 10 days of movement in the sky. These contradictions are the basis for the authority of that man who would reconcile his universe, who would enable in the sky to move from south to the north, and who would enable on earth the people in the 36 temples to realize that they were under one government. Anybody who has read a book, Scott Tenor's work. Who has read Tenor's work? Scott. Scott Tenor's work? No, Walter Scott, nobody reads. He only reads when he's a fool. Really, nobody has read Scott? But not Engelwald, Kenilworth? That's the story of Queen Elizabeth going to Kenilworth Shakespeare. And the main point I want to make in this collection is only that it is called the Queen's Progress. The Queen's Progress, who her life. Now this word of the King's or the Queen's Progress, who has heard the difference? The word is quite important in central to the history of the reign of Elizabeth. Made a progress in one country, because it was the duty of any ruler to go places and to stake out the boundaries of the country by visiting the most remote corners at least once in their way. Was one of point of the grievances against James I and his son Charles I in England that they didn't return to Scotland and never visited, never progressed again through the ring. Well, then the queens are the king's progress. And the word progress, you see, that solemn wording of the original meaning of progress. You have the heritage from Horus. Horus had to travel in order to take possession of the land of Egypt as a unit, from the first cataract to the mouth of the Nile every 2 years. And the government of Egypt was called the government of the followers of Horus, the companions, the boon companions, you may say, of that feudal group who accompanied him on this progress from south to north. All the rest are separate. That his staff, his military power, even they say his entourage, and he, Horus and his followers, are the rulers of Egypt, because they connect these widely outlying districts to the inhabitants. I give you two examples of the importance of this action of this people's program. And this was proved that this meant that these people, thousands of miles apart, knew that they were under one government. Sitting there as bulls, and flying over the river of the Nile as though he was a falcon. The symbol of the king is that he moves on the Nile River as fast as a bird in the sky. So he is a heavenly power on earth. I have to quote this first. He is a heavenly power on earth. He is called Bones the Fall. The enormous of the bones of the top of God appears in Egypt in various names after the Bones.
wonderful carvings of this royal barge, where tremendous wood monument is seated, into which the king, so to speak, had to climb to be the forecourt visibly to all the people whom he passed by. A very late story. In 1872, to supplement this royal barge with the horus forecourt on the Nile River, the whole boat is a very beautiful thing, and you may have read that. Years ago, they unearthed one of these barges around the Great Pyramid. There's a mystery over this discovery, of course. The Egyptians had to find something after the French and the Italian and the German explorers and the Americans had all been driven out, so they decided to make a big splash, have a new pyramid and a new tomb discovered and a new barge, and then silence fell. And we still don't quite know what they really discovered, whether it was just actually very parallel to Mr. Nasser. We happen to know the man who did this and digging, and he's very much a type like this, Nasser. Dry drunkenness without alcohol.
Now, in 1872, 19 pharaonic mummies were discovered in Thebes, in Egypt, and the government sent down a steamboat, very new at that time, down the up the Nile River to get it down to Cairo. And there was a tremendous resistance by the people locally. They are mummies, they are sanctified, they are burial grounds, so to speak, that they should be taken up and brought to the capital of Egypt, Cairo, into the museum, where they now are. And what is so impressive is the description of the German scholar who did this for the government, Mr. Heinrich Brugsch. This man Brugsch says that while the steamboat was passing along all these winding curves of the river, the local people in the various villages and districts were mourning and wailing, as though they were burying their dead, losing their sacred corpse, so to speak, to this central government, which was irresistible because it was the only power that had a steamboat on the river. And they were locally fixed, they were pissed, they are pissed, they cannot move. You must see this tremendous contrast between a fixed, immobile people, population, that lives at such distance that they never see each other, and this one central power that has a navy. It's the first effect of sea power. I mean, I didn't know that the first sea power was inland. The sea power of the Egyptian king made him differ from the people who couldn't budge, who couldn't move. He could budge in flood time, in any time, because the Nile is navigable, of course, through the whole year. The Nile has this one very wonderful quality that downward you can go with the flood, with the slope of the water, and upward there's always a wind from the north, so that you can always set sail and drive up the without using your oar. You can sail up because of this mysterious northern wind, you see? Or you can float down. So downward you go without sail, with the flood, and upward you go with the sail, you see, through the wind. This most mysterious gift, the second gift, so to speak, of the River Nile, you will admit. So Horus the falcon is on earth as a bird in the heavens. But now he's also in heaven, the one thing which the stars themselves cannot be. He is the motor power who carries the sun downwards the river over 1,000 miles. The so-called winged wheel of the railroads. If you go to White River, it's in the
Even today in the waiting room of this wonderful institution called the Boston and Maine Railroad, there is a picture of an old locomotive, and there is a symbol underneath, I think it is, of the two wings that carry the wheel, the iron wheel. Do you remember? This is a symbol which you see quite often. Well, this is an imitation. It was invented for the epoch of the railroads. This winged disc wheel of the railroad is an imitation of the so-called winged disc of the sun. And the winged disc of the sun has long been misinterpreted as though it was a disc of the sun having wings, which is perfectly absurd. The sun just has no wings. But if you think that Horus made this progress through his kingdom, then you will understand why all our oldest texts, that has been now found out by the greatest English Egyptologist of our day, Alan Gardiner, why originally this symbol is the wings of the falcon of Horus carrying the sun from north, south to north and convincing the people everywhere that it is one and the same sun. You see, marching on. You sing of Don Brown's body and the soul is marching on. The Egyptians would sing and the sun is marching on. It is one and the same sun. Here Horus proves it to us. He has the same star map, the same geodetic survey of the sky for all of us. So naive you may say, but also so grandiose is the conception, gentlemen, which Horus represents. Horus represents the conception, the first conception of a land, of a country, of a territory. For you people, perhaps the best word is territory, to make clear to yourselves that it is the first time that arbitrary districts on this or earth are seen as forming a natural unity of manifest destiny. You will not doubt that from California to New York, it's a one country. But don't you understand that this has to be created one day? That it isn't one country at all. It's innumerable countries, is it not? And it has been innumerable countries. At the time of the Louisiana Purchase, nobody ever thought that any of the land beyond the Mississippi had anything to do with the land this side of it. For you, it's all natural, gentlemen. Now, I give you one good advice. Whenever somebody tells you that something is natural, you watch out. You may be sure that it is purely historical. Nothing that you call natural ever is natural. Be sure of that. Everything that is natural is usually 150 years old and was done by human sweat, blood, and tears. It's a very great help for you. You would also understand religion a little better if you would know that your word or the use of the word natural is just fed. For example, I have time to tell you that to go around without a tattoo is unnatural. You see, that's a conquest. Everybody today in the primitive world goes around with a tattoo. Go to Guyana, go to South America. All people who are people are tattooed. You are not tattooed. You think that's natural, you see. You're quite mistaken. It's perfectly unnatural. It's anti-natural. It's an historical event by which you were freed from this terrible, you see, circumcision, incision, all the cruelties of initiation. We don't mistreat you to make you a member of the society, you see, because you don't have to remember the dead. But in the ancient tribe, you had to be made to wail as though it was the first funeral, so they could have enough blades run into your skin to make you remember the event that the great hero is dead and that you have to take over his spirit. It's only an example for the fact, gentlemen, that anything that's worth in your own existence has never come about by nature. Everything is bought at a very high price. You are the most unnatural people because you boast that you are so natural. Because you owe everything to the sacrifices of your ancestors and you deny it. Never seen such ungrateful people. You see, you have this all by nature. Not a thing you have by nature.
No rights exist by nature. Every right exists only within a group. They're granted to you. And that has to be said. That has to be stated. It has to be fixed. It has to be monumentalized. Now, that all Egyptians live in one country, to come back to my starting point, gentlemen, had to be certified. And that is the power of Horus. That he forces the heaven from the south and the heaven or in the north together. Ever since this was done for the first time, gentlemen, 2,800 years before Christ, an emperor in this world had to move south, east, west, and north. The last emperor, of whom I know that he performed the rite, was the last emperor of Austria, Charles VI, or the first, as he was called, the heir to the throne of Francis Joseph of Austria in 1916, when he was crowned in Budapest as a successor of Charlemagne, with the name Kirari, which is a Hungarian name for the Carolingian succession of empire builders. He had to stand there in church with a naked sword over his head and had to strike out to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west. What no star can do. When Cortes landed in Mexico, the great blessing that was said by Montezuma was, the coronation oath which he had to take was, that he would move freely east, west, south, and north, and thereby assure the good crops of the country. It has always been overlooked, gentlemen, that to say this is very unnatural. It is only interesting with regard to the sky, because in the sky nothing moves south and north. Only if you understand this can you understand why the Horus of the Falcon of Egypt, the Pharaoh, wears the double crown. He is more than the sun and more than the moon. As he unites north and south, so he unites the country of the north and the country of the south on earth, or as they would call it, he was the lion of midnight and the lion of noon. The Lion of Judah, as you know, is a reflection on this cosmic title of this Pharaoh, that he was able to shine at midnight as well as in daytime, at midday. This is the obsession of the Egyptians. They have one great reconciler between heaven and earth. As he is the falcon on earth, gentlemen, so he is the bull in the sky. The one who can carry unity into this fortress of the sky and can force it to be one heaven. He can win out against the resisting north. No other star can conquer the north. The north, gentlemen, is shown in our planetariums and in our old horoscopes as the power of sage, the power of the twin brother of Horus. You may have heard these two names, Horus and Sage. They are mentioned very often in our stories. They are these strange brothers who alternate. Everywhere in the world you find these twin gods. You find the god Janus in Rome, you see. You know what a janitor is. He's also this unpleasant man who is just as much awake at night as in daytime for your contraventions. And janitor comes from Janus, from the man who has two entrances, everything twin. Well, that's a very great obsession of all the old people, to have a power who unifies night and day, north and south, sun and moon. That would be the universal god. That would be the cosmic power. Horus and Seth then are these inimical
brothers or twins.
The Gurus always must march against Set and his imperial stars in the north, the Great Dipper, you see. Run on against them, conquer them, and then,
of course, the thing has to be repeated. It is never over, because, unfortunately,
it has to be a dynamic process. By itself, heaven dissolves again into its fragments. That is why Horus, as a dynamic entity or force, is constantly on the move. He is government. He is, the word government comes still to this day, gentlemen, from the power of the men to go down on his boat. To govern comes from having the rudder on the ship. And so the ship of state, gentlemen, is a very genuine idea of the Egyptians, you see. They govern with the help of their ship of state. If the two heavens, north and south, could be united, gentlemen, you had the center of the universe. Because since they were two halves of the, like two halves of an egg, of an apple, cut apart, the victory of Horus over the hostile powers in heaven and on earth, the resistors, Set, the embodiment of this gravity, so to speak, by which the North resisted the Union. The victory had to be celebrated by leading to the residence of this mighty ruler. And I already told you that at the end of the first great year in Egypt, Tel Amarna was fixed at the center of the whole of Egypt. The first capital of Egypt was much more primitive, gentlemen. It was not, in the beginning, you can imagine, was quite impossible to have a geodetic survey of 1,100 miles of winding, swampy river valley. What they did was to divide Egypt into the two parts of the delta, where the land is wide, because there are three big branches of the Nile branching out between the desert mountains, and the upper part with the narrow pipe, the narrow hose, so to speak, leading down from the first cataract. Now Memphis, M-E-M-P-H-I-S, is that center residence from where you can see in both directions. And the act, gentlemen, of residing, the act of taking possession, the act of enthronization, the act of coronation, however, all these expressions are very vital because we all have inherited them. You use them daily, you see, when you say, I sit down, I have settled, I own a house, all these things. The whole vocabulary of civilization comes from this tradition of the Horus taking possession of a territory unified by this victory over the parts of heaven. Well, in Memphis, gentlemen, takes place for the next 4,000 years, ever since it was founded, to the last Sultan of Turkey, the great event of the union of the lands. People have spilled very much ink over this formula, which is written there beautifully. Under the throne of a pharaoh who has been enthroned, there is usually a symbol, the so-called sima. Our vowels in Egyptian spelling are all probably wrong because we don't know them. We only have the consonants. So we say sema, but we don't know how it was pronounced. That means union of the lands. The sign for it is a very beautiful sign, gentlemen. The two lungs, the two lobes of the lungs, lead up to a larynx, and this wide land, this wide territory, has now one voice. out of the mouth of Pharaoh now comes the determining speech. There's one law, one rule, one articulated voice set into the middle of the land. That's why this residence is so important, gentlemen. It's a place where the voice appears, the one voice with which this country can be ruled. Very poetical, very legal, very religious. You see, the same problem arises. Every word in Egypt still has this tremendous power that it is liturgical, gentlemen. And I told you about the tribe, that it was at the same time religious, poetical, and legal. Now you may perhaps go one step further and learn, gentlemen, that the word liturgy, of which you have only dimly recollections from your few visits to church, is the unity of such a language. In the liturgy, we perform ourselves, the divine order on earth, and the living Horus, who took possession of the throne, where he faces back south and forward north, where he looks in both directions, is the great liturgist, the great liturgos of the ancient Egyptian, why shall I call it, empire church or church empire. The ancient, yeah? Terrible. No. 5 minutes. Get going. My story, I must go on. I first want to say what a myth is, can be studied very clearly in the Egyptian liturgy. You use the word myth and mythical so freely that I'm very anxious for that you may learn that this is a very definable thing, a myth, M-Y-T-H. It is, of course, the spirit of the time, or of the space, in which we are, to which we are confined. You live in the myth of 1957. And since 1957 is very benighted, you are deeply sunk into the myth of being at the top of civilization, or being the last man, or whatever you think you are. You see, that's a myth. In the 19th century it was called the spirit of the times. We have now discovered that it is a very dangerous subject matter, so we call it myth. Now the Egyptians had a local myth, because the empires were strangulated by the narrowness of their territory. It didn't coincide with the whole universe. To give you, an example of myth which you may brandish whenever your girlfriend asks you, and which is, I think, very good for you to have as a weapon of understanding in this absolutely ridiculous discussion about myths, which I, for example, had with Mr. Seitz the other day at lunch, where I saw that he just thinks misses everything that is interesting today. That's what it amounts to. Myth is what I do not understand but would like to know. Which is very dangerous, my dear man. Myth is something very specific. The Horus of Egypt went every 2 years with his entourage on this great royal barge down the river. It must have taken him 6 weeks. We have tremendous inscriptions describing his progress. In every one district, he had to kill one crocodile as a symbol of his victory over the obstacles, you see, on the river. And then he had to hunt down some wild boar in the thicket to show that his irrigation ditches would now overcome the wild animals on the sidelines, and on it went. This very dramatic progress of the Horus depicted there, of course, could only be dramatized by going down the river. Then the union of the lands was done,
And then he could reside the rest of the 1 year and three quarters in his wonderful residence in Memphis, or wherever he did choose to reside. And at the union of the two lands, his big throne was established, and there he looked north and south and enjoyed the results of his effort. After 2 years, however, he had to start again at the first cataract. And of course, the whole royal achievement was going south to north, and there was no wit in going north upward the river, also in a great procession. So they had a great myth, the priests would tell in all these 36 temples to the faithful, about the way the Eye of Horus could return from the mouth of the river during this 1 year and a half secretly at night. And they said that at the mouth of the river, out in the Mediterranean where nobody saw, there was a boat waiting for Horus in the sky. It would take him across Suez and the Red Sea and to the Ethiopian mountains, and then at the right moment he would appear again at the first cataract. This is, we have elaborate texts on this, and I only mean to show you that which cannot be liturgically enacted is given over to a myth. The myth is a supplementary story which shows that other half behind stage, backstage problems, you see. You know the story of, and the stage is the same. How do you get out a man out and in again, you see? Several comedies have been written about this problem, how a producer makes a man move from one place quickly to another, where he suddenly then has to appear. You have to make a speech, how he got there, the messenger, you see, who suddenly brings the news, how he oppressed it, you see, the man was married to the famous Oedipus complex gentleman, and the myth must always supplement that which cannot be enacted. That's a story that rounds out the myth so that it becomes a universal, a cosmic story. The limitations of the Egyptian enactment is that the country wouldn't have stood. Two processions went up and one down the river. The great surprise was the conquest with the flood, with the rising flood in July, August, and September, you see, when the flood of the Nile carried this royal barge and made it necessary for him to assert his regime, you see, that this one flood created one land. Now, in the dry season, to go up slowly there with the wind would have been very unroyal and very dismaying, you see, anticlimax, as we would call it. In order not to have this anticlimax, the myth was invented. I have always been to show you how down to earth this problem of the myth is, how inescapable. I want to compare to the complete absence of any myth in the religious services of the Jews and the Christians. After every holy mass, the priest cleans the cup. I think that's one of the greatest acts of the whole mass. You think it's a technicality. It is the one move against myth. Yes, the cup is not holy by itself. It's just an earthen vessel. It's just something monumentally this side, earthly. It has to be consecrated into something more meaningful if you are willing to be the body of Christ during the Mass, the body of the faithful who form one man. The problem of all religion is this, that we form one man, my dear friends, now, from all times. Whether it's a totem or whether it's a Holy Communion or whether it's Holy Mass. Are we all or one body or are we not? We are not by nature. And we are not, if this golden cup would be brought in by some servant and it would be left to some mystical proceedings of preparing the gold and glitter every day again, you see? No. The humility of Christianity is that the whole process is shown, the kitchen process, you see? The dishwashing process is shown. And if you do not realize that in this dishwashing, the same humility shows as in the whole walk of Jesus on this earth, you haven't understood Christianity. You
because it means that we do not take exception in any of the necessary earthly acts of our disposition. We do not pretend that our Savior flew like Vulcan through the sky. He walked the earth, as any one of us. The Egyptians, the poor people, in order to create a territory, they had to create this myth that Vulcan Horus was flying through the air, or on the river like a Vulcan. Therefore, the mystery, and we do not see how he returns from the mouth of the river. You see, that stage. We have in Christianity an open stage. There is no bed stage in Christianity. Everything is above board. Dirt, death is above board, the stinking corpse, everything. Sweat, toil, and tears. The mythical story is that certain things are too disagreeable to be mentioned, too bothersome, too laborious, and so we have some backstage secrets, and when the curtain rises, as the coronation is on, we don't know how it all happened, how they all got there. That's by and large the same as with the coronation, where all the preparations are also not shown in lifetime, unfortunately. But the coronation itself is. Goes over television, you see. You only see it from beginning to end, but you do not see the debris, you see, in everything that went before. This is myth. That the myth supplements liturgy in as far as the liturgy is locally and temporarily partial. And you must understand this is vital for your survival in these next decades, gentlemen. You must set your mind adamantly against this confusion that anybody dares to call Judaism or Christianity mythical. I hear this everywhere in this country by the enemies of all true faith. It is just common. Everybody in Dartmouth takes the liberty of calling part of our religion myth. It's a fight against myth. And my example is a very clear example of something mythical. And the washing of the cup in the sight of the faithful is a reminder that there is no difference between living room and kitchen, and that the backstage doesn't exist in the revealed truth of our mortality. Man doesn't only live, he also dies. Man doesn't only eat, he also shits. That's a true story. And most of you only want to live with one half of your existence, with the nice half, with the advantageous half, with the pleasant one. You're all pleasure seekers. Suffering, death, sickness, old age, all these things mustn't exist. You'll all live mythical, gentlemen. That's why it is at this moment. You see, in the 19th century, people had to fight against the spirit of the times and say that they were eternal things. Today, I have to fight to make you see that you live in a mythical state, totally mythical, because you never ask yourself what it costs to abolish now you become all Egyptians and to be the slaves of big corporations. You are all Egyptians. You all live for the standard of living. I told you that's the flesh pots of Egypt. Now you can do it if you know what you're doing. But you must know what it costs to become an Egyptian. And to elect your president only on the proposition that he is a pharaoh of Egypt who looks out for prosperity. Gentlemen, that's something totally new. George Washington wasn't made president of the United States for prosperity. That was your private business to be prosperous. Today you elect the president in order that you have higher wages. That's pharaoh of Egypt. That's a mythical existence which you lead. Because the real background of the discipline of this country is, of course, its power to defend itself and to make sacrifices by its citizens and make goodwill all over the world. It cannot be done by Washington and by a passport bureau. I mean, one man of these journalists who went to China is more important as an American than 10,000 people who tour Europe in the summer. Isn't that obvious? Yet you think they say to us in Washington that the 10,000 people who go to Europe are the law-abiding citizens. But when the four journalists who went to Peking, for Piping, they are the law-making journalists.
They are the men who still carry America. But we have this myth today that if you live in this rotation of crops and in this rotation of seasons and this rotation between vacation and the curriculum, you do your duty. You don't do your duty. You dream. You live in a myth.
Well, I don't want to say any of these things, but I'm forced to say this because today the one great lure by which they lure you is that the people tell you everything is myth. You see, in the 19th century, even a man like Mr. Reinhold Niebuhr, who is very rueful about this now, called Christianity an ideology. Then it became nothing better than communism. Now they call Christianity a myth. It's very refined, this way of abolishing our only salvation, of getting out of this myth. So I warn you, gentlemen, the myth is the supplement of a liturgy. And any partial empire or tribe has to have a liturgy which pretends to be more universal than it can be. This travel of the Moros through the Red Sea includes territories which made no part of Egypt, which were outside the sovereignty of the Pharaoh of Egypt. So he became, you see, and that every empire has done, he laid claim to a larger part of the sphere of the world than he had a right to do. Any myth claims more power to a partial or local order, you see, than it has a right to claim. It's the same with your fashion, gentlemen. Television is a fashion, or the $164,000 question. Who will speak about the $64,000 question in 20 years? But you don't believe it. You think it has to be spoken about. And this poor man Van Doren loses his mind over it. Well, there you are, gentlemen. That's the spirit of the time. That's your myth. You have a time myth. 20 years from now, you will have another time myth. That is, you will be crazy by the craze. You will be ridden by something everybody has to say or to think or to debate, and 5 years later, everybody will scratch his head and say, why was I ever interested in the whole thing in the first place? It is perfectly superfluous. You live from these crazes, don't you? You live by these temporal myths. And the difficulty for you to know this is only that in Egypt, in the empires, the myth was locally grown by a certain geographical unit separated from the rest of the world. But gentlemen, you are separated from me and my ancestors and your ancestors by a wider wall than the Egyptians were geographically by the walls of their desert. You live in a temporal myth and you are totally sunk into it. Your Nile is the wavelength on which you listen to the nonsense that goes over the air. The word myth has to be therefore, I don't know what to say, I mean, not exposed, but understood, looked through. You must be totally aware, gentlemen, that we all live by myth. Fashion is a myth. The necessity of wearing, that we should wear different dress from the women. There have been times where people, men and women, wear the same dress. You see? It's not very important to look through this myth, but we have to learn what is temporal, what is passing, and what is purely local, and what is permanent, and what is everywhere. The empire is a genuine effort to make every one part of the globe where such an empire exists a mirror of the whole sky. And the tragedy of any empire then is that it always is bigger in its claims of celestial order than it can practically on earth perform. You have no empire where, except Charles V, the sun never sets. Yet any empire claimed that Horus was the power that rules day and night, in a sense that he had an empire where the sun never set, that it coincided with the whole globe. Pharaoh and all later empires, gentlemen, had a title which expressed this very clearly. It was the term Cosmocrator in Greek.
the ruler of the cosmos, of the created universe. The Emperor of China, therefore, was called the Son of Heaven, of the whole Emperor, of course, although only in China. That's why the Chinese is not interested in anything outside China for the 3,000 years they were. This was the only country in which there was new celestial order. All the rest was not. An Egyptian to this day looks down on the Bedouins or on us foreigners because his country is right. So, gentlemen, central government and the feeling that you are in the middle of the universe is a condition of empire builders. And the pyramids then around Memphis stand in the center of Egypt. And every one pyramid is an attempt, gentlemen, to point out to heaven that this ruler is centered at that place where he can rule the globe, where he can perform up and down the river, and where he can perform up and down the sky. What is a pyramid? A pyramid is an oriented building, as you know, which the living pharaoh starts to build when he begins to rule, and on the top of which the sun and Sirius, the brightest star of the night, meet on July 19th. Every pyramid has to be measured in that way, that at the high point, the brightest star of the night and the sun, the only star at the daytime, meet. Because that means that Horus is the architect, the engineer of heaven, who has joined midday and midnight, north and south. For the Egyptian gentlemen, night and day and south and north are perfectly identical notions. Just as I tell you about Horus and Set. Horus the unifier and Set the destroyer of the unity. We think of no longer in terms of the line of midnight, but you still can see it. You understand that midnight is north. Gustav Adolphus of Sweden was called the savior from midnight because he came out of Sweden into Europe for the Protestants to save them. I must point out this to you, that the language of the whole tradition of the empire builder, still in the Revelation, by the way, of St. John, in the eternal Jerusalem. That's the last empire projected into the sky and dissolving all empires on earth, you see. That all of these have this, lay this heavy stress at the perfect harmony between day and night. In St. John's Revelation, if I remember rightly, there is no night. It's day all the time. Day and night unified. Also, there is no temple any longer in the celestial Jerusalem at the end of Revelation, because it is an anti-Egyptian writing. Egypt has to be superseded. It's the great victory of the New Testament over the Egyptian darkness, the Egyptian superstition, the Egyptian prisons and castes. So the pyramid stands near Gizeh. Who has been in Egypt? Anybody here? There are 40 pyramids next to the centerpiece of Egypt, built in the third millennium before our era. We know of 40 still. That's a tremendous achievement. But that comes now to the point I wish to make, which you know we are finding in the books again. It's very strange. I always see the interesting facts never are mentioned. No son of any pharaoh has ever continued any incomplete pyramid. It's a man's business to immortalize himself. You see again the complete contradiction to the graves of the ancestors in the tribe. It's the man, the living pharaoh's own business to immortalize his regime. If he dies before the pyramid is finished, it remains unfinished because his son is a living Horus. The present, gentleman, eclipses the past, as it has no future. It is rotating. It is revolving. The stars are revolving. The living Pharaoh, gentlemen, does not, like any heir in a tribe, have the duty, you see, to sacrifice his time and his money and his workmanship for the pyramid of his father. I think that's most significant. You read in all your anthropological nonsense books, they are really nonsensical because these people have no experience of life themselves, these anthropologists. They never ask themselves what's the minimum for the cohesion of any human society. The minimum is that the dead are kept alive with their meaningful life in the living, that heaven speaks to earth, and as we shall see, that the future is kept open. The anthropologist thinks anything goes. You can have any nonsense of an order, and it's simply born in order. That's not true. The pyramid, therefore, gentlemen, is a great break with the tribal tradition. In a tribe, no living chieftain gives a damn for his funeral in his own days, you see. The heir, the next generation, has to sacrifice everything to the dead man. His wife, his horses, his arrows, everything is put, as you know, into the grave with him. His helmet, and so on. Very different with the Egyptian pharaohs, but this difference is never mentioned, that a pyramid is something sociologically or legally, you see, religiously, totally different from a chieftain's mound or a grave of a hero in a tribe. It is, because the man himself, as soon as he crowned emperor, feverishly begins to build his pyramid. And the longer he reigns, the bigger his pyramid. That's the whole story. The big pyramid took 30 years. Now, very few people have the privilege of governing 30 years, you know. We have one pharaoh who lived even 60 years. But he was a little child when he began to govern, and probably the building of the pyramid started a little later. That was, his name was Pepi. Now, this is to as far as the riddle of the pyramids goes. The pyramids, gentlemen, are the condensation into one building of the whole length of the Nile Valley as the power of the ruler in an orientated way, just as a holiday like Easter or Yom Kippur is the one day that stands for all time. So the pyramid stands for the whole of Egypt. It's the whole realm. And he proves it because day and night, Sirius and the sun meet on top at the moment when the big rush of the Nile waters begin. His priests have observed right, his messengers have come in at the right time. On July 19th, the flood rises and the whole machine, the MoMD, can begin. The great apparatus is set in motion. It's terrible excitement each time. I told you, it takes 5 years to get going, and the 5 years are devoted to the main five members of the divine family, Isis, Osiris, Nephthys, Horus, and Sin. So these 5 days are just the enthronization of these five gods who have to cooperate so that Egypt can be formed. That's the whole story. Well, what time? Oh, 10 minutes. So let's make it 10 minutes. Okay. So the sky over Egypt, gentlemen, has the function of being the newspaper for the whole country. All politics in Egypt have to be expressed in star law. If something has to be done on earth, it has to be the will of the stars in heaven. Because otherwise we are not on time. And this has given rise then to the fundamental ritual of the holy wedding, the sacred wedding between heaven and earth. Isis is
the goddess in heaven, who is the original goddess who marries the god on earth. In our Greek tradition and Roman tradition, as you know, and even the Germanic tradition, as far as there was one in Celtic tradition, the thing is in reverse. We have now to ask this simple question, gentlemen. What we have inherited from Egypt occurs in our European tradition, your background then is the same, in a reverse order.
And this is the last thing I would like to explain. The River Nile is symbolical in Egypt, and the fertilization of the river is said to be the beginning of this country, of this one country. It's a process of procreation. Egypt is procreated by the union of heaven and earth. They thought, by the way, that the Nile water was not only coming out of the first cataract, but they're straight from heaven and went in Egypt. Now, the funny thing is that if you have in these old empires to constitute connections between something that goes on before and something later, they will not call it cause and effect, if you make a note of this. The pre-Greek expression for cause and effect is beginning and birth, procreation and birth. I think it's a much more, by the way, reasonable expression. They had not they didn't know anything of cause and effect. They come from the law, you know, from the law. But please go, and I also speak, by the way, in my own language, always, of beginning, of procreating, and being born. The pre-person thing. You see, the birth of the child is certainly not a cause, but the child is begotten. It's a more complex and more realistic thing, because the love of the parents cannot be combined. That's an act, a free act in itself, a creative act, and the result of that is the birth. Now, for the Egyptians, therefore, gentlemen, the birth of Egypt, of the land of Egypt, was the result of the holy wedding between heaven and earth. And the semen, the sperm, the power, the potency, was in the river water, which overflowed. Therefore, the male was seen to be lying on his back and sending up his semen, his fertilization, into the womb of heaven. Very strange technique, which I have to mention and which you must take with some reverence, because it is the great mystery of mysteries in Egypt, that the picture of the beginning of Egypt was, or the symbol, you may say, kept in the darkest secrecy of the various temples, was a female prophet being fertilized by an erected membrane virilis, the erected male rod of a man lying on his back. That is a very perverse thing. No bird ever conceives, of course, in this perverted order, but also human beings do not. The mystery of Egypt then was, as with the tribal order, a reverse again of the common experience of men that people have forgotten in the order that the man is above the woman. The Egyptian radical dialectics went so far that they reversed the order. And again, I remember finding in the books the first dynasty already, from the year 2800, has given us in the excavation of the last 10 years, so as old as 2800 for France, and for France, this oldest symbol of the river, this deep secret, that heaven has to, you see, be fertilized by earth. Again, explaining the role of Horus. Horus is more powerful than the Sanctus, because he can fertilize, or you can bring about this wedding, this sacrifice. Well, it's a very complicated. What you have to keep in mind is that in a country where there's no rain, as in Egypt, the fertility cannot come from heaven down. Whenever you come to Europe, however, or to Vermont and to Hampshire, it is obvious that the irrigation comes down from heaven. It is not clear in Arizona, where again it comes out of irrigation ditches. But here it is obvious that the God who fertilizes would be in the sky. It would be the sky God. And that's why the Europeans have Zeus in heaven, and Juno, or Hera, or Priam, on earth. And the sacred wedding, then in Homer, for example, what is first described of it in the Greek text, is so that Here, H-E-R-A, is lying down and Zeus is embracing us. Again, in the normal human way of conception. I have to let you in onto this deepest secret, because we live in these empires, in these traditions of the sacred marriage, or sacred wedding, I prefer to call it, everywhere, and you can't escape reading anthropological books about the sacred wedding. But they never ask the first question, who is on top and who is below, and why is that so? You will find that in all civilizations, where there are river floods and river inundations, the male god is below, and the female is in the sky. And wherever then that is replaced by a slow process of migration and transference, the transposition to northern countries, who introduced agriculture, the natives, imitating the Egyptians or the Mesopotamians, you see. The vision is the other. The vision is that the sky god sends the rain down, and in Greek, for example, the same verb was originally applied for raining and for begetting. It was one and the same word for Zeus, to rain down or to fertilize the land. It was one act of procreation. I think it shows you, gentlemen, nothing crude about these people. I hope I honor you for having remained serious about this. To me, this is very serious. These people had such a desperate necessity of justifying their own political position, this order of the land, that they allowed the pharaoh to marry his own sister. So they also allowed, so to speak, the perverted order of heaven and earth to come into being, just to justify this tremendous achievement of creating one territory. And this is what I wanted to tell you today completely, that the tribes created the first era of generations of men hanging together. The thing that has made Egypt immortal and will keep it before your interest is what it costs to create one country, to make it indestructible. And if you still want to be after 4,000 years, nobody has robbed the Egyptians of the unity of this stretch of land from the first cataract to the mouth of the earth. This is perfectly fantastic, is it not? You have no other single item in history where the same territory has remained united over so long a time. Think of it, Italy was divided for much more of its history into the most incredible parts, the Spaniards in the south, or the Normans, you see, the Roman emperors, the French, the Turks, everything was in Italy to be held, the Albanese in the center of Italy. And not at all, Egypt is one creation. And I think it has been preserved for us to study the beginnings or the entrance of men's power to write into the soil the order of the sky. Egypt is the power of inscription forever, for millions of years, as you said. We wouldn't say that, but they already used this for millions of years. intensified agriculture.
So, I think my time is up. I'm sorry.
Don't forget to pass around these 360 and 5.